Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 264, recorded Monday, September 12th, 2016. Mark McCahill. Triangulation is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/triangulation and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/triangulation. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you fresh, high-quality ingredients to cook delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. And by Tracker. Tracker makes losing things a thing of the past. Pair Tracker to your smartphone, attach it to any item, and find its precise location with the tap of a button. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter the promo code TRIANGULATION for 30% off your entire order. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology. We spend time with them. You get to ask your questions via our chat room, irc.twit.tv. And I'm really excited about this one, but that's because, well, I've been around a while. And if you've been around a while, you know one of the things we like to do on this show is talk to the people who invented the technologies that changed our lives. And Mark McCahill absolutely did that. He's currently at Duke University, where he's working on network infrastructure and collaborative teaching. But he's been around for a long time, a programmer who worked on, okay, now this is a test. You ever hear Gopher? I know you've heard of Popmail. he was the first to coin the phrase surfing the internet, and you may know him better as Pixeline Mistral, the editor the editor of the Alphaville Herald. Mark, welcome. We'll have to explain that later. Welcome to Triangulation.
Glad to be here.
Hey, it's great to have you. Tell me how you've been involved in the internet since the early days of the internet, before the World Wide Web took the world by storm.
Yeah.
Tell me how you got involved in all of this.
University of Minnesota had or was on the internet, and actually there were some guys there who were hyping the idea of, hey, things are all connected together. There's a guy named Tom Jacobson who was running around saying, hey, there's this really cool stuff, and got some of us interested in, there's this thing, FTP, File Transfer Protocol. Mark, look at this. You could, like, transfer files from here to a machine in Chicago or the other way, back and forth. It's like, huh, well, that's pretty cool. So because I happened to be at Minnesota, and because there were some crazy guys in the computer center who were getting this idea of there's an internet and things are connected together out, we were kind of aware of it.
Was it the ARPANET then, or was it actually called the internet?
We were connected to the NSFNet. National Science Foundation was paying for a backbone for a bunch of the research universities to be on. And mostly it was physicists using it, so I got involved partly because the physics department got some Sun workstations and wanted someone to be a sysadmin. And so I didn't know that much Unix at that point, but I figured, well, I'll buy a book and I can stay 2 weeks ahead of grad students. And I did. And that was enough to be able to stand up a little Sun cluster and admin the thing. But because that was connected to the campus network, that also meant that I was on the internet or the ARPANET stuff at large, and started playing around with it a little bit. So it was kind of a natural progression from that experience to looking at some of the stuff we were doing. The Popmail stuff we did with email was, hey, we want to do email. Well, we should probably use a protocol that would, like, work over this internet thing. So
email without the internet would kind of be less than useful. Well, it would be mail. It would be Unix mail, right?
Well, but back in those days, there is competition for the internet. There was something called BitNet that was an email, kind of a bucket brigade email system. So it wasn't absolutely clear that TCP/IP and the internet were the right thing to do.
Interesting.
I mean, there were religious wars about what's the right thing.
Well, that's so kind of anyway. How Usenet, it still works, right? It's not exactly internet. It's you pass things along.
Yep. So we got going a little bit with playing around with this stuff and ended up, because we wanted to put together a little library or a little program to do email, got some experience writing software that would do TCP/IP and writing stuff that would run on Macintosh computers. We were huge fans of Macs.
That's interesting.
Back then.
Wow.
And that sort of set the stage for doing something like Gopher, because we already had the ability to write client-server TCP/IP, a.k.a. Internet-style programs. So we went from there.
I mean, in those days, the computer didn't come with a TCP/IP stack, right? I mean, you had to do
yeah.
You had to write your own software or find libraries and add that to the computer. I remember that because on Windows machines, there was Trumpet WinSock and things like that that you would have to add, install on your computer so that it could talk to the internet.
Yeah, Apple was actually a little bit foresightful back then because they had a TCP library that you could add on. At one point, they were thinking of stopping supporting it, and a bunch of us were at the Apple Developer Conference begging them, no, don't do that. He'll break all our stuff.
That makes me wonder how inevitable the internet was. It almost sounds like it was the accidental internet. Could have been Bitnet. Could have killed TCP/IP stacks.
Well, on one level, you could say at the time it seemed like it wasn't inevitable, except that a lot of the competition was too centralized in the sense of it was very difficult for little group to, like mine, to play around with stuff and build something.
Right.
When you make the barrier to being able to build something really high, then it's harder to grow organically. And since the barrier was low for the IP stuff, it grew organically. And I think that ultimately is why stuff won, or the internet won.
And that's a real lesson. I mean, we see that time and time again. If it weren't for the unregulated 2.4 gigahertz spectrum, we wouldn't have, Wi-Fi wouldn't be ubiquitous. If it weren't for the fact that mainframes are too expensive for individuals to own personal computers, Woz wouldn't have built an Apple.
Right.
So I think there's something to be said for engineers want to scratch their own itch. They want to have these tools. They're expensive. Unless you work for the Rand Corporation, you probably don't have access to them generally. So you make your own.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I want to talk about Gopher. And Gopher's not dead. Gopher's still around. It was, in effect, the predecessor of the World Wide Web. In fact, maybe we can do a little gophering because I think people are still running Gopher servers.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there are still some out there. And they've done some crazy stuff, too. I saw somebody a couple of weeks ago. I was looking around. Somebody set up a gateway between Gopher and Wikipedia so you can
nice.
Have a Gopher interface to Wikipedia, which actually works pretty well because Wikipedia tends to be quite a bit of text, a few pictures. And Gopher could handle some pictures. So there's that kind of stuff out there still.
I'm looking right now. I'm running Arch Linux here, and I could install GoFish on here and create my own Gopher space. It's part of the Arch disk. It's in the Arch user repository, but I can install GoFish. And I wonder if there's a Gopher. Yeah, here's a Gopher browser. Wow. From the University of Minnesota. So that's still the canonical Gopher browser.
They're still out there.
Wow.
Part of what I think made Gopher successful was we made it super easy for someone to have their own Gopher site. And we also made it so it looked like your site had a lot of stuff on it, even if you had almost nothing there. Because you could make links to other sites' stuff. And, people who started at your site would kind of go, oh, wow, look at all this cool stuff there.
This is a Gopher space through a web interface at quux.org. And this is what Gopher looked like. We'll browse around a little bit. It was basically a text menu system.
Yeah.
And you could dig and drill down. But I have to think that, of course, Tim Berners-Lee, before he invented the World Wide Web, this is probably the interface he used. Whoopsie. This is probably the interface he used. I think the hard drive that this is running on is dying. and maybe this kind of inspired the idea of hyperlinks and all of that.
Some of what was going on, too, was we've been talking to the librarians a lot, and librarians are about organizing and categorizing information. So the idea of having collections of information and having meta information, you know, information about the content, that was like what we thought it was an important thing, and librarians were into that in a big way. Tim's approach was much more with the, I want to link things within documents to other documents. So I want, you know, to be able to hop from one part of a document to another part effortlessly. The after we'd seen that, I started thinking, well, that's a kind of a good idea, but what bothered me about the web was that the page description language didn't give you much control about how the page rendered. I mean, what it would look like. It should look, I thought, like, you know, I want control.
You mean as the user you wanted control?
Yeah, I want it to look the way I want it to look. Right. I don't want to put in these tags and then hope for the best when someone renders it.
Oh, so okay. As a publisher, you wanted to control it better.
Yeah. So I always thought that what would have been better than, or maybe a good competitor for HTML, would be PDF documents with links in them. Ah. But I could never get the people who are doing Adobe Acrobat and that stuff to pay attention and say, would you guys just put some links in there? It would have been interesting to see if that idea had gotten going early enough, how well the HTML stuff would have fared against it.
That's very
because
interesting.
PDF gives you real control about how things look, right? I mean, you can get exactly the font you want. You're not sending some hints that, you know, I'd kind of like it to have serifs maybe if you feel like it today. But so it goes.
It's the challenge for web developers. Every browser does something different with your code. You have no idea what's going to happen.
So if you're interested in presentation, the web stuff is kind of crazy, although it's gradually worked its way around to giving you enough control that you can kind of predict what things will look like. There are counter arguments for why you wouldn't want something like PDF, but I don't think that idea ever got a fair shake in the marketplace of ideas. People just kind of went, whoa, the web, let's just do that. It works now. And maybe that's another lesson. Something that works now beats something that might be better and will work later.
Right.
Working code always wins.
Right. We're talking to Mark McCahill. He is the creator of one of the creators of the Gopher protocol and Gopher servers before the World Wide Web. That's how you surf the net. He actually coined that term. And there's lots, and pop mail, there's lots more to talk about in just a bit. So hang tight here. We're talking to him in his lab at Duke. And I can call it a lab because you have motherboards and a whiteboard. And that makes any room a lab, I think.
Yep.
Now it's a lab.
Makes it home.
It's home for sure. Exactly. We were talking before the show, Mark and I both have that Apple IIFX Macintosh motherboard. I framed mine, which only keeps it from getting dusty. That has no other purpose. Our show today is brought to you by Wealthfront. If you have to save, and you do for the long term, you've got to invest it. You can't just put it in your mattress and hope for the best in 20 years. We're all saving. I hope you're saving for retirement. I hope you're saving for a rainy day fund. You're saving. Maybe you're saving for a down payment on a house or your kids' college fund. There's lots to save for. But what do you? How do you do it? How do you invest it? Do you do the research? You know, I think a lot of us geeks, especially, we're cocky. We say, "Oh, I can do this. I can figure." I did that. Read all the books. Read books by some of the best people like Burton Malkiel and Charles D. Ellis. And I learned, and I said, "I'm ready." And I launched into it and opened a brokerage account and invested. And then I got busy. Life, and you know, you check it every first. You check it every month, then you check it every quarter, then you check it maybe once a year, then maybe you stop checking it entirely, and then you come back to it 5 years later, and it's, oops, maybe I should have been paying more attention. Wouldn't it be nice to have somebody do that for you? Now, wait, I know you're going to say, but an investment advisor, I mean, these guys take 1 or 2, in fact, often 3% of your money every year. It means you have to make 3% more that year just to break even. And it's hard enough making money on the markets, they take that 3% off the top is crazy. And that doesn't even include transaction fees, hidden costs, and of course, the awareness of, well, is this guy doing what's right for me, or is he trying to just, you know, run up some transactions so he can make more money, or maybe even sell me into a stock that he has a commission for? This is not the right way. What you want is Wealthfront. Wealthfront is computerized investment and is scaring the pants off of those brokers who want to run your money, because it's, first of all, instead of 1%, 2%, or 3% a year of fees, it's a 0.25%, 25 basis points, 0.25%. And the computer is doing it right. There's no emotion involved. It, you start by answering a few simple questions about your time frame, your tolerance of risk. It'll design a portfolio for you, and then it monitors it not monthly or quarterly, but not even weekly. It monitors it, not even daily. It monitors it constantly because, well, that's what computers do. And it's constantly adjusting to make sure you're diversified. It's doing things like tax loss harvesting to maximize your return and minimize your tax bill. This is really smart stuff. Based on all those books that I read by these guys right here, people like Burton Malkiel, who wrote The Random Walk Down Wall Street, Charles D. Ellis, who wrote The Investor's Guide, they've encapsulated 200 years of experience on Wall Street in the software at Wealthfront. It really works. But I just want you to go to wealthfront.com/triangulation and read up about it. I'm not saying invest, although you can start with as little as $500, so it's easy to dip your toe in this. And they will, and this is a great way to start a nest egg. If you're young, you should really be doing this. Just a couple of minutes, answer the questions, open an account. The first $15,000 you put in there is free of fees for life. Not even 0.25% a year, nothing. So you really, that's going to get you started beautifully. If you did that when you were 21 and just left that there, you'd be set for retirement. It's really amazing. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. But read all about it. There's lots of stuff you can get for free from them when you go there. You can actually answer those questions and get a portfolio, the initial starting portfolio that they would invest in for free. So if you want, you could just get that and then try that. They use ETFs, which is a really great way of making a diversified investment. Very smart stuff. You can also go there and give them your existing portfolio, and they can give you some idea of the risks that incurs, how diversified it is, what your fees are costing you. And actually, that's a real eye-opener. It really is. This is a great solution. And no wonder Wall Street's a little nervous. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. I really think you'll be interested in trying this out. We're talking to Mark McKay-Hill at Duke University. He is an internet pioneer. I love talking to internet pioneers, and the creator of some of the protocols that you probably still use, Popmail. Many of people still use Popmail, although it's being slowly superseded by IMAP. You probably don't regret that, Mark.
No.
No. It's time, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this stuff isn't forever. Yeah. Ideally, someone comes up with something better that, displaces the old stuff.
It must be kind of fun, though, to go to somewhere like, QUX.org and see a Gopher server running and be able to browse it. And it's, in a way, we had Ward Cunningham on a little while ago, and I have a feeling Wiki was probably also very much influenced by what you were doing with Gopher. The idea of links and digging down and references is just a compelling idea.
Yeah, and I think another piece that makes this stuff all hang together is the idea that once you have this kind of distributed information system with a bunch of links and things spread around, you got to have some kind of search engine to go with it.
Right.
So what always comes with those things is some sort of robot that goes and crawls through the whole hierarchy and then indexes it and makes it searchable. So Gopher had that stuff way before anything like Google existed.
So you had a spider, a crawler that would go out and look at Gopher sites and aggregate it. And then were you also doing federation of the content?
Yeah. Actually, the guys who are doing, where were they? Nevada? University of Nevada. There were some guys who were doing a thing that would crawl across the internet gopher space and make an index of it that was searchable. They called it Veronica, which bothered the guys who did Archie. Peter Deutsch and Alan Emtosh hated that name. They really did, because they were nervous that comic book guys were going to get after them for using the name Archie. And it's like, no, there's copyright. Don't be doing that. But we talked to the guys from the UNR who did this and said, well, you know, Veronica is pretty good, and we could probably come up with some kind of acronym. So, you know, it's so it was very easy, rodent-oriented network, something like that.
That's called a retronym, right? Where you have the name, yeah, and then you go backwards and say, what could that stand for?
Yeah.
Oh, but see? See, Your Honor? We weren't thinking of comic books at all.
No, no, not at all. But if you think about it, so you had FTP, which was the de facto distributed information system before Gopher got any kind of traction at all. And the Archie guys went and did a crawler and did a search index. And that was really cool. And then we did Gopher, and the same thing happened there. And then the web came, and the same thing happened there. That it always happens because you need some way to search the stuff.
Sure. Yeah, it's no good if you have a – well, and that was the really – that was the thing that really made a difference. It really changed things was, you know, you go to the library, and search is very primitive. You go to a card – in the old days, go to a card catalog, and it's alphabetical. And then there's this weird Dewey Decimal System, and you had to kind of know that. And it was very primitive. So it makes sense that as soon as you've got information digitized, you want to take a step beyond the card catalog, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at what happened back then. This is right when microcomputers are getting really popular. Now everybody's making the content using microcomputers, so it's all digital already.
Yeah.
Now there's also cheap connectivity, and the internet, with the idea of federating this stuff, made it so we're in this perfect storm of everything's turning digital, and it's cheap to connect, and there's the idea of categorizing it, and there's the idea of making it searchable, even though it's spread all over the world. That's where the popularization of the internet came from.
Yeah.
And we happen to be at the right place at roughly the right time, along with quite a few other people. I mean, I look at Peter Deutsch and Alan Emtage doing the Archie stuff. They were doing the same kind of popularization. They were just working on the older tech. And what Tim Berners-Lee and company were up to was, again, the same idea of, hey, we could take this digital stuff and make it much easier to get at. So it was a fun time.
Very easy, rodent-oriented, net-wide index to computer archives.
Ah, there you go.
The chat room is good. I don't know if Eric Duckman knew that or looked it up, but either way, that's a retronym for you. That is awesome. So, but Archie was the first search engine for Gopher.
Well, it was the first search engine for FTP sites.
Oh, Archie was FTP. That's right.
But what we were doing with Gopher was to make Gopher look bigger and plumper than it really was, since there aren't that many people running those servers.
Right.
Is we wrote a gateway between Gopher and FTP, so all of the FTP sites appeared from the Gopher client as if, you know, it's just more Gopher stuff.
It became an interface to FTP, in effect.
And so you'd also want the interface to the search engine. And the same sort of thing happened then when the web's starting to get more popular. Initially, there weren't that many websites, so they also would support Gopher and kind of embrace and extend. Everybody was doing that to make their thing able to get to pretty much everything else.
It's actually interesting that Gopher's still around and Gopher's still being run. And in fact, you can still run your own Gopher server. The Federation still exists. If you go to QUX, you'll find a list of a number of other Gopher servers that you can link to. And you could still do kind of what we did in the earliest days of the internet and hop around from server to server and find interesting stuff. And it really is a rabbit hole that you fall down because you click that and you go, oh, and you click that and you go, oh, and you, by the time you're done, it's late at night and you haven't had dinner. I remember it well.
Thank God for software archaeologists.
Yeah.
Dig this old stuff up, dust it off, and put it in museums.
Well, is it the equivalent of vinyl, you know, fanatics? Or, I mean, in some ways, it's kind of refreshing because it's fat. It's really fast. It's not graphically heavy. You don't need a lot of hardware to do it.
Yeah, well, it had to be fast because everything was slow when we built this, right?
Yeah.
The lack of ads, too, feels just bizarre when you go there.
Oh, it's so nice. It's so nice.
Well, it's different. I mean,
right.
When we were doing Gopher, there were, for large swaths of the internet, acceptable use policies that said this is research and education only, no advertising here.
NSF did not allow commercial use.
Right.
So, in fact, I remember, I think it wasn't that long ago, mid-90s, when the NSF said, okay, That was a big shift. I just read an interview with the first employee of Amazon, and he said when we were putting Amazon.com up, there was a little bit nerve-wracking because it was commercial, and it wasn't really clear how much commercial stuff you could put on NSFNet or the ARPANET or the internet, in the nascent internet. It was non-commercial. Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to worry about ad tech. You don't have to worry about spying. You could just go around and actually get data. And I remember, I was telling you before the show began, I remember my first encounter with the internet was Gopher and Archie, because I was on The Well, which was a message board out of San Francisco, and you could drop out of The Well. You could drop to the command line, which by itself was kind of an eye-opener. All of a sudden, you're in a Unix command line. And then I ran Gopher, and it was like, that was my first experience of the public internet. It was like, wow, there are lots of people here. You're right, it looked fatter than it was probably.
Yeah.
But I thought, there must be a million people using this.
No, 100,000 anyway.
At least. it was pretty cool. I can't remember if that predates probably running. I ran a BBS in the early, maybe not. It was right about the same time I ran a BBS for Macintosh fans out of San Francisco, which was, if you think about it, very much like Gopher. The early BBSs, it was a FidoNet, were very much like Gopher, menu driven. You drill down, all text.
Yep.
But sometimes I feel you're right. When you say you see no graphics, no commercials, it's snappy, it's fast, it's data rich. It does make you feel like, gosh, we kind of lost something. The internet's now very much like downtown Las Vegas.
Yeah, totally.
And this is more like Tombstone, Nevada. I expect Wyatt Earp to come out of one of these.
With a couple tumbleweeds rolling down the street.
It's not interactive in the sense that you see other people there. You don't see video. You don't see graphics. But you definitely get the underlying sense that there is not only that there are people, but there is a lot of information. It's a very, very big world out there.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I used to love demoing was the Usenet cookbook, because there were all these people who had contributed recipes to a cookbook that were mostly from Usenet users. But hooking that up to a search engine and being able to type in, you know, what do I want for dinner? Let's put in some words and then get back a bunch of recipes. That usually was a total crowd pleaser, because it was the idea of regular people can use this for regular kinds of stuff. It's not necessarily for science-y, research-y stuff. It's, hey, this is stuff that, like, my mom and dad would care about.
Yeah, you can start to see the value of it.
Yep.
Yeah. We're talking to Mark McKay-Hill, the creator of Gopher, the creator of Popmail. But you also worked very early on. I mean, I'm talking mid-90s with VRML and virtual reality. So I want to talk about that as well.
We came out with the original Gopher stuff, and that got some traction, and then people wanted to do more with it. So we thought about it and said, okay, well, let's add in the ability to put in additional information beyond just like, here's the name of the thing and where it is. Like, here's the document and its location. So we said, we'll add in this extension to the basic protocol, a place to hold all sorts of meta information, like authors and whatever you want. Then we started thinking, you know, it would be really interesting, since we're thinking about how documents relate together, if we could somehow put these in spatial relationships to each other. So we could say these things kind of clump together over here, and that document's sort of related, but it's over there. And the computers are getting just barely fast enough to kind of render 3D stuff, which is actually part of why I have that Mac 2 and Mac 2 FX motherboard. We were a beta site for those because we were trying to push the envelope a little bit with saying, can we do 3D scene rendering on those first generation Mac 2s? So we started saying, well, we've got a place to hold the 3D coordinates for the things. We could define the scene in the extensions. Let's see what we could do about making 3D part of the Gopher stuff. So around the time the VRML thing was going on,
That's in Motif.
Yeah.
Early graphical interface for X11.
Wow.
And I remember doing a demo of this once in Austria, I think it was someplace, or maybe in Germany. No, it was Austria. And they had this huge screen, so it was like really cool. It was this big, big screen. And we had this deal of we wanted you to have an overview of the 3D scene before you were in it, so we'd have you kind of fly down and land. But I didn't realize until I showed it on this huge screen for a bunch of people that people are like holding on to the arms of their chairs going, oh.
An early taste of what virtual reality is going to do to everybody.
Yeah, maybe that wasn't the best move for at least a really big thing because it's too immersive that way. But what it took to make that stuff even work at all on those machines, I mean, they didn't have, like, graphics chips, really. We were happy that they had floating point in hardware. That was, like, the breakthrough that made it kind of possible. Yeah. But there was no Z buffer and no GPU.
So you had to simulate. You had to basically write your own code to do all of that. Wow.
Well, we were basically looking at the same sort of stuff that the game engine guys were having to do to make things work there, which was a real education. I learned a lot about how to make things run real fast with not much in the way of hardware.
And then get this. The code was stored on the University of Minnesota FTP server, and something went wrong, and every file larger than 96K got corrupted, and the software was lost. There was no backup?
Well, I think I had some.
according to Wikipedia, you were able to recover it, but all the publicly available copies of the source code were lost for for 3 years.
I don't know about maybe.
For maybe more than 3 years until you recovered it in June 2008, it says here. We can correct the Wikipedia if that's
wrong.
Yeah,
this sounds like another case where you can't totally trust Wikipedia.
It's a great, you know what? Lie, Mark. It's a great story. It was lost.
I just kept my own copy of everything in a couple places.
Smart man.
I learned super early on.
Smart
like
man.
My first microcomputer experience was in a chemistry lab when I was an undergrad at the University of Minnesota. And I was doing lab work on like wastewater effluent. We're looking at chlorination products of that stuff. And they'd gotten an Apple II. And so on the weekend, I was in there playing, literally, just playing around with the Apple II because I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I wrote this nice program, and then this lightning storm came through. And as I was saving stuff, and my program was gone. The floppy disk was corrupt.
Oh.
And I learned an important lesson that day.
Back up.
I want three copies of everything, always.
Yeah. Holy cow. Yeah, that's terrible. I think that's happened to everybody, though.
I think it has to happen. It needs to happen early. Yeah. So, and then after that, you know.
For some of us, it was merely that we spent 5 hours typing in a basic language listing from Compute Magazine. and then it failed as we saved it to cassette. That kind of thing. Or the power went off. Or your mother picked up the phone and broke the modem connection. Something bad happened. And that's when you learn. Wow.
Jingling the keys on the phone was really good for killing the connection.
Really? That just...
Totally. That would take it out. You didn't need to pick it up. Just jingle your keys on the handset. That's enough.
Was it the sound or it just...
It's the sound.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was enough to break up the... Amazing.
Yeah. Some of the programmers back then would just take the keys out and look at the other guy and go, oh, okay.
What a threat. Oh, that's hysterical. We're talking to Mark McCahill about the good old days. But I want to talk about the present too, and I want to talk about Second Life, you've been involved with this kind of 3D stuff for a long time. I'd really be curious what you think of the current crop of VR and where it might be going. But we'll do that in a second. Mark McCahill is our guest on Triangulation. I'm glad you're here for this. I'm sorry. Sometimes the young kids are going, oh gosh, do we have to hear these old war stories? But it's good. It's good for you. Listen to your elders. And the folks our age are going, I remember that. Veronica, our show brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is a wonderful company that is, their mission is to make incredible home cooking. I'm reading it right here. Accessible to everyone while supporting a more sustainable food system. right? Setting the highest standards for ingredients, but this is the most important part, and building a community of home chefs. Now, the problem is easy. You know, we all work really hard, and it comes to the end of the day, and the last thing you want to do is figure out what you're going to cook, go to the market, get the ingredients, you know, and then go home and cook it. It's like, so you end up, you either go to Applebee's or Burger King, or you make something that you know you have in the refrigerator. And I'll tell you what, there's not, and I'll take it from me, there's not a lot of stuff you can make with mustard, a head of lettuce, and a bottle of capers. You just, there's not, you can't. So then Blue Apron came into my life. I love this. Once a week, we get the Blue Apron box inside. Three different meals, okay, for two. Now, they also have a family plan, so you can get the family plan. And all the ingredients to make that meal, by the way, it's not, nothing is frozen. Everything's fresh, even the meat and the fish, they're fresh because it's refrigerated. And if you need one tomato, there's one tomato. One clove of garlic, there's one clove of garlic. Three ribs of celery, it's just what you need. So there's no waste. It also includes the recipe card. And you have everything you need in about half an hour to 45 minutes to put together an amazing meal. The house fills with this incredible smell. Everybody's saying, what are you cooking? Oh, I'm just making Korean pork tacos with spicy red cabbage slaw. No big. And your mouth is watering. And you sit down to a healthful, balanced meal that you made yourself. And all of this costs less than going to the grocery store. Grocery store is about 60% more expensive than Blue Apron because Blue Apron doesn't have the brick and mortar, the clerks, all the trucks, all the stuff that they just, you know, it makes it easy. And by the way, when they say highest quality standards for the ingredients, they're working with 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers. The seafood is sustainably sourced. The beef is raised humanely. The chickens are free range. It's the stuff you would buy. Pork is raised naturally. They use regenerative farm practices. And you'll learn about, you see, they even include a card about, that you can learn about the farm and the farmer who grew the vegetable you're eating. They do the family thing. If you've got kids, they'll give you, you can choose from kid-friendly recipes, you know, and it'll serve the whole family. And the kids can participate. On average, research shows Blue Apron families cook together three times more often. And there's something so valuable about teaching a child how to make the meal, how to, having them involved in the preparation, all sitting down together. This is what you want. And you can try it right now. You're going to get three meals free if you go to blueapron.com/twit. You get to pick what you want. They have vegetarian meals, of course. Dietary restrictions, no problem. You go to the Blue Apron site. You see what's on the menu that week. You pick what you want. They will never repeat, which is really nice. You always have something exciting and new and different. So it doesn't get boring. It's just, I'm such a fan. Blueapron.com/twit. Your first three meals are free if you do it right now. Blueapron.com/twit. We're talking about the good old days, but I think we're going to talk about modern times too with Mark P. McCahill. He is a software engineer who created some of the earliest and well-known at the time internet protocols, including PopMail, probably the mail system you used for years until IMAP came along. Gopher, which predated the World Wide Web. When did you come up with the phrase surfing the internet?
That was during the Gopher era. The reason for that is I was way, way, way into windsurfing back then. Surprisingly enough, if you don't live there, Minneapolis is a great area to sail.
You don't think of it that way, I admit.
The lakes are frozen for part of the year, but when they're not frozen, there's a lot, the weather changes, so there's a bunch of fronts that come through, so there's plenty of wind, which is perfect for if you're into windsurfing. So I was doing a ton of windsurfing. So the idea of talking about, you know, surfing between sites, surfing the web, surfing the internet, it's just like beach jargon. So I didn't surfing. Think of it as some like big deal. It's like, you know, it's just,
it caught on. Surfing. It caught on because it's such an apt metaphor. It's really what you feel like. You feel like there's this wave of information and you're riding atop it. And Gopher really did that. Now, here is, by the way, is the source for the Wikipedia article. It's an email in 2008 from Maurice McCarthy. Hi, all. With a little effort, managed to contact Mark McCahill, one of the originators of Gopher and the principal writer of Gopher VR. He has posted, quote, what looks like the source code online for us, as said below. So there is an email to back this up. They actually had to get a hold of you. And it was something you were working on, croquet, at the time, I think. So you talked a little bit about croquet in the email. What was croquet?
Backstory was that I'd done some 3D stuff and internet stuff, and got an introduction to a guy named Julian Lombardi, who was at University of Wisconsin-Madison at the time. Julian was really interested in marrying 3D and the internet in a little different way, and I ended up talking to him. We're going, wow, you know, stuff we've been doing is kind of faintly overlapping. We should, like, think about this. And Julian said, there's some guys down that he knew from when he had a startup here in North Carolina. There's some guys that are doing some interesting stuff. We should talk to David Smith. So we ended up talking to this entrepreneur, David Smith, who was involved with Alan Kay and some of Alan's research group doing a peer-to-peer 3D internet-enabled system called Croquet. They needed more people who wanted to work on this, and we were both super intrigued. So it's like, yeah, this is really cool. So we kind of threw in with those guys, convinced our management at both Wisconsin and Minnesota to let us work on this a little bit, and spent some quality time working on Croquet, which in many ways has super, super cool ideas, but it was hard to get a lot of traction for a lot of reasons. One of them was that Alan's research group was getting supported out of HP, and then management changed at HP, and Alan's guys all kind of scattered because Alan didn't have funding, and so, you know, that kind of stuff can slow a project down. But the Croquet thing came out of, since I'd been poking around at 3D stuff before, and I got an introduction to somebody else who's doing it, and we're both still thinking it was pretty cool, hey, we should do something with this. I was really lucky to get involved in that thing. I got to meet one of my absolute heroes, Alan Kay, out of the deal.
Because it was written in Smalltalk.
Yeah. And I got to spend quality time writing Smalltalk, which I learned a lot from doing. There are many, many powerful ideas in that system. So all in all, it was a great experience, even though we didn't get a whole bunch of traction out of it. I learned a bunch of things that we end up reusing in different contexts going forward. So...
yeah, it's interesting how many roads lead back to Alan Kay and Smalltalk.
Well, Alan's had a lot of really good ideas right over the years.
Yeah.
Like you could say a whole bunch of the stuff that we're using came from ideas that Alan and his group came up with and then did at least a proof of concept, and then other people would take the ball and run with it. Like the whole user interface that we use on Windows and Mac, right? Where did that come from? Alan had seen some of Doug Engelbart's stuff, but Alan's demo for Steve Jobs probably was pretty influential in how things change.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. You probably don't write in Smalltalk anymore.
I wish I could. A lot of the stuff we're doing these days is in Ruby, which feels vaguely like Smalltalk, but it's not quite the same, sadly.
The thing that's unusual about Smalltalk is it's an operating system as well as a language. And so you're working in an environment, I mean, that is your operating system, but it's also the programming environment.
Yeah, and if you need to change the operating system, you can do it.
while it's running.
Yeah, while it's running.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could change it back, too. And if you're not careful, you can screw yourself pretty well, too. But
just save your images regularly. So that's the key to, again, backup. It's everything.
So anyway, the Croquet thing got us going, and then how I got introduced to Second Life is actually related to this. At that time, the people running Second Life would occasionally invite other people from other projects to come and do like some kind of meetup thing in the Second Life virtual environment.
Interesting.
And so Julian and I think David Smith got invited to one of their, you know, meetup things. And Julian said, hey, you should take a look at that. It's kind of an interesting environment. So I took a look at it and said, yeah, this is actually pretty interesting. But I wasn't that interested in it for the tech. I didn't think the technology itself was – that wasn't blowing me away. What I found interesting was the sociology.
Yeah, no kidding. No the social, kidding.
Social computing means you're going to have social problems in a huge way.
Yeah.
And that environment definitely – created the conditions for having big social problems.
Griefing became a real issue on there.
Well, that's the metagame for a bunch of the players right. there when you come down to it.
Right.
And that kind of indirectly led me to the whole Alphaville Herald and Pixeline Mistral pen name thing. I got interested enough in the social aspect that I started reading some of the sites covering this. And the one that I found the most interesting, that I thought had the most lucid coverage of what was going on, was the Second Life Herald or the Alphaville Herald. And then I read up about that and read about Peter Ludlow, the founder, getting kicked out of The Sims Online. He got banned from writing stuff about
He was a philosophy professor at Northwestern.
Yeah, he wrote some stuff about how the game governance wasn't that good in The Sims Online, and they ended up banning him and created a big firestorm about that. So I got interested in the Herald and liked their stories, and then for fun, because I'd always liked writing, wrote a couple on spec and got connected to the guy who was running it at that point. Mainly, Peter wasn't doing that much with it, Mark Wallace, and they liked my stories, so I just kept writing and... I found out a very interesting thing, which was if you wanted to study the sociology of the game, the best thing to do would be to be a reporter, or quote, reporter. And from there, what would happen is people would come to you with the stories, right? You didn't have to go and look stuff up so much. People are always coming to you and saying, hey, there's this outrageous thing happening over there. You should write about it.
Yeah.
Or these guys are doing bad stuff. So, it was quite interesting as a way of getting a deep insight into the crowd psychology of what goes on in these kind of online, quasi-anonymous online communities.
No one knew it was you for years, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't think that was important for them to know.
No. Yeah.
Also, I felt that, and still feel, that the gameplay in Second Life, and I think it's a game. It's a pretty good game, but it's a game. The gameplay totally involves that being that what you are not, because you can't represent yourself very well in that environment. So don't even try.
Right.
I didn't.
Right. Second Life, no one knows you're Mark McHale. On the internet, no one knows you're a dog.
Ultimately, now they do, and there's a whole story about how that happened. But
were you outed?
I ended up in a very interesting situation. There was one group that was griefing or thought to be heavy-duty griefers, and they were probably troublemakers, and another group that thought that they should police them and started surveilling those
kind
guys.
Kind of the worst of the real world in a enclosed space.
It was a dystopian surveillance state for sure.
Exactly, right.
So I wrote a series of stories about this because one group had penetrated the defenses of the other and gotten a hold of the wiki. They were making a wiki of tracking all of their enemies. So we ran a bunch of stories about this, and the guys whose wiki had gotten published filed a Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notice against the Herald. And so I was kind of stuck. I could either take the stuff down or I could file a counterclaim, but you have to file counterclaims with your real name. So I outed myself so I could file a counterclaim. And then those guys decided they didn't want to go to court and we won. But that was when I ended up linking my identities, yes. It was a good reason, though.
Well, and did you find that changed the dynamic in Second Life for you?
Well, I was getting kind of tired of the whole thing by that point.
It was time
anyway.
To give up, to stop doing
so
it.
So it's like, I think I've seen just about enough because the themes start repeating themselves. But, it was kind of fun in that at that point, it's like, okay, well, now – since I've outed myself, I might as well go, meet Peter Ludlow. What the hell?
he wrote a book. I think he wrote a book on the MIT Press about his experiences with this, right?
Yes, he did. And when he wrote that, Pixeline's in there, but he didn't know who Pixeline was at that point.
Interesting. Did you present it as a woman? Is Pixeline, it sounds like a female name.
Pixeline was a reporter girl.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
And that also is a great sociological experiment. I think every man should at some point experience what women experience on the internet. It's kind of hard to believe.
Once you've done it, you kind of go, oh, yuck.
You gain a respect for any woman who is public on the internet, that's for sure.
You guys should should behave yourself a lot better.
Men are bad. Let's face it. So what lessons did you learn, do you think? What sociological lessons did you learn in this experience?
The architecture of Second Life, the controls on who can do what, in some ways I almost think were maybe not intentionally, but they left them the way they were. They were such that it created drama that didn't need to be there.
Oh, interesting.
Because you had everybody in the same simulation and everyone could affect that simulation, well, that's the recipe for griefing, right?
Right.
If you want to make trouble, I want to screw up your gameplay somehow. Well, if we're all in the same simulation and I can affect it in a big way, I can definitely grief you. And that model of people have to be able to come and run their programs, because the avatar is really just a program in somebody else's simulation and can totally affect it, that's a recipe for trouble. I mean, there's a classic series of Herald articles about these chickens that they had in Second Life and people coming and killing the other players' chickens.
Oh, Lord.
And the reason that other players would kill chickens sometimes was if you were farming chickens, you would slow the whole simulation down. And if people are sharing the simulator, they don't want your chickens slowing down their gameplay. On the other hand, the people with the chickens are saying, you're killing my chickens, the poor defenseless chickens. Why are you doing this? So another big lesson is if you don't have agreement on what the narrative is, that's another recipe for huge, huge social strife. And what I just described, there's totally conflicting narrative, right?
Yeah.
Lyndon Lab equals chicken murderer. Yeah.
Well, here's the lesson. Maybe I'm trying too hard, but it feels like Twitter is suddenly discovering all of this anew. And I feel like we're going to learn this anew each time we create these environments.
Yes. Twitter's architecture is, again, totally... Maybe not by design, but they haven't fixed it. It's built in such a way that it maximizes the psychic violence between the players. And that's probably
you were trolled mercilessly. I mean, people were horribly abusive to you as Pixeline.
Yeah, Pixeline on some levels, though, is just another troll, too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Another troll in the sense of, well, I can write a story and, you know, you might not look so good in the story.
Right.
Of course, I can't go too far with that because I'll blow my credibility. But some of the people, there was one guy who had the saying that if he saw Pixeline coming in one side of the simulator, he was going out the other side as fast as he could go. He didn't want to be in one of those stories just on the chance that, you know.
Do you feel like we're worse in these environments than we are in real life, though?
Yeah, because there are fewer consequences. I mean, at the end of the day, what happened in that game world is not of any particular consequence.
If your chickens die in Second Life, who cares in the real
world? Well, you care. And
there's emotional consequences.
Yeah.
Personal consequences. Yeah.
Nobody's going to punch you in the nose unless you happen to be in the same physical place. So. Right. There's maybe the idea of psychic violence without physical violence, and I think that takes some of the governors off. Also, this feeling of anonymity is another one that takes some of the governors off.
I think, I'm sure you remember, one of the things that people really liked about the internet, one of the things that made us think it might be a utopia, is this notion that you could be whoever you want and you could be anonymous. And I'm starting to rethink the value of anonymity because it clearly has its negative sides.
I think what we're missing is some kind of reputation system.
There you go.
Right? Because you could be not tied to a person and still develop over time some kind of reputation. Certainly up until when I had to out myself to fight that stupid takedown notice, I had invested quite a bit of effort into having at least some kind of reputation for that anonymous character. The real problem are the throwaway accounts where there's no even intent to grow some kind of reputation or maintain that. That's the tough one.
Yeah.
Of course, there's also the model of, well, if you can't have a good reputation, but at least you could be famous for being really, really bad. And that, that's
well, and yeah, you could be Hitler in Second Life without consequence. And even yeah. I think that might be kind of fun.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
I mean, just to try it.
Yeah. What I found really interesting, too, is after I started going to some of the Second Life conferences, I'd meet people who were kind of notorious griefers and troublemakers. And
they were nice people, weren't they?
Mostly they weren't that bad in
yeah.
real life.
Yeah.
They could be real dicks online, but
yeah.
in real life, you know, they're reasonably okay.
No, that's been my experience too. And that's why I feel like there's something about these sites. Maybe it's partly the anonymity, but it's other things as well. But in that which just doesn't happen face to face.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think there's multiple drivers. Some of it is lack of consequence. Another is the architecture of the environment and the tendency towards rewarding psychic violence. At least with notoriety, maybe you get a really bad reputation for that, but there are some people who are up for having bad reputation is better than being totally unknown.
Exactly.
And then the last one is if there's no shared narrative of what we're trying to do and there's no place for the troublemakers in that narrative, well, what are they going to do but make a lot of trouble?
I really like that third one because that's counterintuitive, but not counterintuitive, but it's not immediately obvious. It's very obvious that anonymity and lack of consequence can bring out the worst in people. But I love the positive idea that if there's a story that people can participate in, which is what real life is, right, is you can create something together, then maybe people it'll bring out the best of them instead of the worst of them.
Well, you look at something like the game EVE Online. EVE is interesting because there is a place for the troublemakers, right, in the narrative thread. There's low security area, no security area where anything goes, and it's okay to go and infiltrate and destroy the other faction stuff there, even though you're bad guys in some sense. It fits within the whole narrative thread, so
right.
it's not
okay.
a jarring experience
right.
that it is in, like, Twitter or some of the Second Life things.
Trolling or griefing is when you have a nice thing and somebody comes in and destroys it or damages it. If it's if you're in chaos, if you're in the chaos world, no problem. That's the narrative.
Yeah. So I guess the trick would be to architect one of these social systems where there is a place for that chaotic stuff to happen that doesn't totally screw up the rest of the narrative thread.
Yeah. We're talking to Mark McKay Hill. He is an internet pioneer, but as you can see, very much involved in modern times as well. I want to talk about VR when we come back in just a moment on Triangulation. It's great to talk to you, Mark. Thank you for spending some time with us. Really appreciate it. Our show today brought to you by Tracker. I'm a key loser. I admit it. I misplace things all the time. The Tracker is the solution. It's a little Bluetooth device. I have one. Where's my Tracker? I lost it. You're laughing at me now, aren't you? As soon as you pair it with your phone, you're not going to lose it. So what happens is it's about the size of a quarter, very lightweight, anodized aluminum. The nice thing about the Tracker, it's one of the few devices in this category that you could change the battery on. Most of the other ones, when you're, you know, after a while, you throw it out when the battery dies. I don't like that. The Tracker, it's easy. I've replaced the battery on them. It's trivial. You can buy the little dime-sized batteries and refresh it, and it's good to go. They've really improved battery life, too, on the new one. The Tracker Bravo is fantastic. It's if you've tried Tracker before, you'll really love the new Tracker. Put it on your keys. Put it on your pet. Put it on your remote controls. Put it on anything you lose. Pair it to your phone. Your phone will then have a map at all times of where your devices, your things, your pets are. Now, you might say, because you're smart, wait a minute, it's Bluetooth, Leo, right? 30 meters, 100 feet. What happens after you get out of Bluetooth range? That's when it gets really interesting. It is nice, though, because you can pair it with your phone. You can turn on two-way alerts. So if you leave your phone behind, the Tracker will beep at you. Or you leave the keys behind, the phone will beep at you. So that's just a nice thing to have a reminder. As you walk away from your phone or keys, you're going to get notified right away. But so those are two-way separation alerts, which are great because you get notified before you lose your thing. There's even a button on the Tracker, which is nice. You can push it and your phone will ring or scream or whatever sound you apply it. You can have any sound you want. And even if it's silenced, it'll do that. But When you get out of range, out of the Bluetooth range, here's the beauty of the tracker has a crowd GPS network. It's the largest in the world. 1.5 million trackers are out there. Whenever your lost item is seen by anybody running the software on their phone, because it's Bluetooth LE, the phone sees it and then notes its location and then sends your tracker software on your phone an update. So your map gets updated as strangers walk by your lost keys. Leave your keys on the beach. The next guy walking by who's running the tracker software will update your tracker app. It's pretty awesome. They also have the new Tracker Atlas that works with your Tracker Bravo or third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your stuff in your house. You can customize the floor plan of your house. So now, not only do you know your keys, you left your keys at home, you know you left them in the couch under the cushion, which is pretty awesome. This is the solution. Easily track everything you lose, and you'll never lose it again with the tracker. Right now, if you go to thetracker.com and use the promo code triangulation, you'll get 30% off your entire order. You can get, because it's anodized aluminum, you can get it engraved. Great if you're putting it on Fido. It's even small enough you could put it on a kitty cat. And they have a little waterproof thing you can put it in. You can get with that. So the cat or the dog, even if they get wet, the tracker continues to work. You can also have pictures now. They have UV printing on them. That's what's on the tracker that I lost. It's here somewhere. Don't laugh at me, Mark. It's here somewhere. Oh, here it is. It has a picture of me and the Triangulation album art on it. Actually, it's quite pretty. THETRACKR.com. That's the hardest thing to find, is the website, because they left out the E between the K and the R. THETRACKR.com. The tracker, and don't forget that promo code triangulation for 30% off, and that even includes if you get, like, pretty pictures put on your tracker. Mark P. McKay-Hill is our guest. We're talking about the old days of the internet, but also the modern times, because, you know, it's so interesting. People like Jaron Lanier and you and early pioneers in VRML and so forth, here we are 20 years later. And it's as if it was just newly invented, right?
And we're still waiting.
By the way, some might say it's not much better. At least you don't have to wear... I mean, I remember SIGGRAPH in 1993 wearing a giant helmet with a big, long cord coming off of it attached to a Silicon Graphics workstation. At least you can do it now with a fancy PC and lightweight thing.
Or a cell phone.
Yeah, well, actually, with Google Cardboard, a cell phone is powerful enough. That's right, yeah. Yeah. What do you think?
I think it's a real hard problem to crack, to get the latency down. I think that's really, really, really tough. And the optics are not easy either. Interestingly enough, David Smith, one of the guys we worked with on Croquet over the last couple of years, did some work on some thing called the Wearality VR rig that is... Fresnel lenses, so he's got a really wide field of view.
Interesting.
And then you drop in your big format cell phone. That one doesn't make me as queasy as the other stuff, so wider field of view helps. But the queasy factor, too many people feel not quite right doing that. So I'm a little bit skeptical about the immersive VR thing right now. I haven't seen one that... doesn't make me feel odd after a while.
I'm with you. And I was very excited about this. Of course, we bought a Vive and an Oculus Rift. I was a Kickstarter contributor on the Rift, and I played with the PlayStation VR. We'll buy it when it comes out. But I don't find I spend a lot of time in it. It's cool. It has a high cool factor, and you can see where it's going. But I sometimes wonder if the problems aren't intractable. It's not even not merely latency and frame rate. I think there's also this issue, and others have raised this, of the difference between the convergence distance of the thing you're looking at and the focal distance of the thing you're looking at. And the disconnect tells your monkey mind you ate bad mushrooms and you should throw up right now.
Yep.
And that's kind of fundamental. That's hard to beat.
Your eyes doing the wrong thing to focus on this, so something is definitely wrong.
You're hallucinating.
Something bad is happening. Yeah.
Yeah.
The current 3D stuff that I think is interesting is the visualization and 3D printers. I think that stuff where you can design or look at things in 3D on the computer and then print it out and have a physical artifact out of it.
Isn't that amazing?
That is what's cool.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
And we're seeing a bunch of that here at Duke. I was just earlier today over at a building we just remodeled, and there's one wall that's got 65 3D printers on it. The computer center has gone from being, in the really old days, the place where the printers were, because you know, people would run their jobs on the big machine and then get it printed out. Now what we're doing is running this huge array of 3D printers because there's a lot of that going on. And that's something where individuals probably don't want to have their own just yet, right? It's not like having a printer at home. It's a little bit more of a pain to maintain the thing.
Yeah, you very much want the priesthood to keep the thing running. How many spools have I destroyed? And, and it gets all tangled and it's a mess. And, yeah.
Yeah, we're going through an astounding amount of filament, too.
Yeah, I bet. Oh, that's really interesting. That's kind of cool. What about augmented reality? That seems to solve the visual issue because you're still in the real world. You're just superimposing stuff on it.
Yeah. I think that there's some interesting possibilities there. A lot of the stuff I'm interested in these days, though, are either in the how can we enable stuff for the 3D printing or how can we come up with the big data stuff that would let you figure out where to put some kind of augmented reality marker in the real world.
How interesting.
That seems like something that could have an impact sooner rather than later. That whole VR thing is for somebody else. I did my time trying to get that stuff to work well enough. And it's like,
And I feel like they still haven't solved it. And they keep promising, if we just get the frame rate up, it's all going to be better. And I'm not convinced.
I'd love to be proven wrong. I'd love to see one that really rocks, but I'm not holding my breath right now.
Well, you probably, I would imagine that you were influenced by Neil Stephenson and Snow Crash and the idea of getting up and getting in the metaverse.
Yep.
I want to plug in. I want to jack in. I think that sounds, I hope we get to that in our lifetime.
Yeah, well, back in the Gopher days, we were reading Stephenson and Rudy Rucker's software. All of the developers working on Gopher in the early days were reading those books back then.
Sure. And Neuromancer, right?
Yeah. Yep. So hugely influential, but it is science fiction for a reason.
I wonder, actually, if that's – I've often thought this, and I've proposed this to scientists who poo-poo it, but I've often thought that many scientists, computer scientists, engineers, and scientists in physics and other areas, astrophysics, grew up reading science fiction. And a lot of what they try to accomplish is informed by what they dreamt about as teenagers. And that's one of the reasons we're spending so much time on VR.
Yeah.
We all want a metaverse.
Yeah. I talked to a bunch of the guys my age in the software field, and almost all of them were huge Robert A. Heinlein fans from when they were little kids, right? That was one of the things you read. It's like so influential.
Absolutely. Mark, it's a pleasure talking to you. And it sounds like there are a lot of young people at Duke who are lucky to have you around. As a gray eminence.
Yeah. I was doing a lecture a couple of days ago, a guest lecture thing, telling students in a software class about, here's all the stuff you can use. And one of them decided to look me up, and he said, hey, you have a Wikipedia page.
I'm going to listen to you.
I said, you'll have one too. Just give it time.
Give it time. You can still play around in Planet Croquet. There's actually a Squeak image, a Smalltalk image that you can download and run and play with it. It's been updated. I see it's last updated September 12th, so that means today. So there's people still working on it. You can go to I always start with squeak.org because it's really a wonderful thing to play with.
If you wanted an interesting kind of VR thing that we did in Croquet. This was an interesting idea David Smith had. The idea was you'd be in a 3D scene and you'd want to be able to reveal more information about it. So he had this idea that you should be able to have some kind of like window that you could pull into place. And then when you looked through that, it would show you more detail about what was going on. So it was like magic spectacles that you could like layer on top of each other, which seemed like some kind of augmented reality in a virtual reality thing. I always like that idea a lot. I've just never come up with a good use for it, but other than, you know, it's a really cool demo.
There are mist-like games that do that. There's a game called The Room that where you get a little thing and you can see magic markings if you look through it. I think that that's a great idea. I love it.
Yeah, well, we did a little bit with putting it, you'd be able to put annotations into the scene, but you didn't want it cluttered up with a bunch of, like, tags, so the only way to see them was to drag this magic viewer over the top, and then you could look at it and then pull it out of the way and not see them.
You should call it the HoloLens.
Yeah, or something like that.
Mark McCahill, such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for spending some time with us and
fun.
Going back down those pathways, but also talking about what we've learned. I mean, this is one of the things that, unfortunately, we keep reinventing the wheel because we don't learn about all the lessons of the past. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. I like it if you watch live. You could be in the chat room then. There's a technology that predates the World Wide Web. Probably even predates Gopher, IRC. But I love it, irc.twit.tv. You can use your browser if you don't have an IRC client and join us. If you can't, though, of course, on-demand audio and video of every show we do is available at our website. In this case, twit.tv/TRI for Triangulation. Or you can subscribe. There are podcatchers all over the place, iTunes and the like. There's even Twit apps on every platform. You can use those and make sure you capture every episode because you don't want to miss one of these. It's an education all by itself. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.